Welcome, everybody. This is the first lecture of the inaugural session, perhaps of many more, of the Economics of the Great Depression, where we're going to be talking about the Austrian view of the Great Depression and the New Deal. And today's lecture is on the gold standard and Calvin Coolidge. And here's an outline of how this works, or what we're going to be talking about tonight. So let me just mention a few things. There are a few people who have never taken a course from us before, so I don't want to just leave you completely in the dark. But on the other hand, I know most of you have taken it, and plus, there's a lot of material, and I'm sure you guys would rather hear me lecture on the material than do the logistics. So just very briefly, if you have a problem, you can email the Academy people and that stuff. Those emails should all be in the email that you're getting. If you're not getting emails and you're a registered student in this class and you want to be getting the emails, like if you didn't tell someone to turn them off, then let us know. My email is, well, I'm gonna give it to you on the next slide. You'll see in a minute, so I'm not going to write it out. So just generally speaking, if you have a technical problem, meaning you don't know how to log in, you forgot the password, or you just don't understand, oh my gosh, when is the quiz, or something like that, email the Academy staff, because I know less about computers than you do probably, so I can't troubleshoot on a technical issue, or like you can't hear the sound, or something like that. But if you have a question about the course, in terms of, I don't understand this point, or are the quizzes mandatory, that kind of thing, then email me, and that's fine. If you do email me, though, put Academy, the word Academy, put that in the subject line of the email, because I get a ton of email, and it all comes to the same inbox, and so I need to know it's coming from you guys who are my enrolled students right now, so I look at your email first and not let it slide off my inbox page, okay? So make sure you do that. Very briefly, the lectures are always going to be on Fridays at this time. On Saturdays, there's going to be optional office hours. So because this class is just starting today, I didn't even think of it. Generally, I'll give you a couple days warning. Like on the Thursday, I will tell you this coming Saturday, the office hours session will be at such and such time. All right, so this week, you're going to get pretty late notice. Like I'll send you an email late tonight once I figure out what the time should be. So the Saturday sessions, completely optional. You don't need to watch them in order to get 100% on the exam and the quizzes. It's just there if you want to ask additional stuff about this course or anything else. And so like I said, I'll typically on a Thursday, I'll send you an email saying, hey, this Saturday at such and such time, I'll be tuned in for an hour like we're doing right now, so you'll be able to live chat with me, and there's fewer people who go to that, so we can just go back and forth. You're typing your questions in the chat box and I answer them on the fly. These things are all recorded. If you miss a lecture, you can go get it, or if you want to review it, there's weekly quizzes. You're going to have 2 weeks in which to do them, right? So a quiz will get posted and then you'll have 2 full weeks. So the quiz for week one will be posted, and then you'll have 2 full weeks in which to take it. And then when the quiz for week two is posted, you'll have 2 full weeks. All right, so there's going to be overlap. You know, at any given time, there'll be at least 2 quizzes open, typically, until the end. All right, and then there will also be a final. You don't have to take the course for credit if you don't want to. If you just want to tune in and watch, that's fine. You don't need to tell us that you're not taking the course for credit. If you just don't take the quizzes and you're racking up a bunch of zeros, we're going to assume you don't want to take the course for credit, so you don't need to let us know that. I think that's about it. Why don't I go ahead then and jump into the main lecture. Well, one last housekeeping detail. This is completely optional, all right? You don't need this in order to get 100% in the course. I'm not trying to make money off you guys, but I had some entrepreneurial error. I ordered too many books for this event that was in Nashville recently. I mean, it's not really an error. It's just you don't want to go to an event and people buy your books and you run out of inventory, right? So you always, as a speaker in these kind of deals, bring more books than you think you could possibly need to sell, and that's what happened here. So my point is I happen to have a bunch of these sitting 5 feet to my right here, and maybe we can come up with a mutually advantageous thing. So if you are interested in getting a copy of this and you don't have one, obviously for this course, this would be a good book for you to have. There's a lot of stuff that I can't get to in 5 weeks, and let me put it this way. There is actually a lot of original research in this book. It's not just that I grab stuff, you know, from Rothbard and from Hazlitt and from so-and-so and Bob Higgs and just synthesize and put all together. I actually went out and dug up some new material that's in this book. So if you haven't read it, I would recommend that you do read it if you're interested in this topic, obviously. But it's not mandatory. If you want to, email me and we can figure out what, you know, what the price, because you might want some other books I have, and, you know, I can autograph them and all that jazz. So let's just email me if you're at all interested in getting this. And I can get them out quickly so that you can have it. So in other words, if you email me this by this weekend, I can get the thing in the mail to you before Thanksgiving. I mean, I'm not saying you're going to get it before Thanksgiving, but I'll get it out in the mail, so you'll get it by like the second week of this course. Okay, so Calvin Coolidge, let me spend a bit of time talking about him. And this was one of the things that I learned going over the material for that Great Depression book, that Calvin Coolidge actually, as far as presidents go, was a pretty cool guy. All right, now, of course, as a good anarcho-capitalist, I don't endorse any president. They're all thieving, warmonger, killers, blah, blah, blah. Praise be to Murray. But you understand what I'm saying. As far as these things go, he's actually pretty amazing in many respects. I don't have the URL to give you right now, but if you go to YouTube, type in Calvin Coolidge, I think it's an inaugural address. And it's, I believe, the first recorded such thing of a president. And you can see a YouTube clip of Calvin Coolidge giving a talk. He's certainly not Martin Luther King in terms of delivery, but the content of what he says is pretty extraordinary. And on this particular YouTube, and then he's got all kinds of various quotes and so forth. So just, you remember, you say, wait a minute, why does he have such an odd period in office? Well, because, so it was Woodrow Wilson and then Warren Harding, but Harding died, and so then Calvin Coolidge was his vice president, and he gets sworn in, and then Coolidge wins his own election later. Okay, so that's the reason for those, that odd amount of time in office. And in my book, we're not going to be able to get into it today, it's pretty charming about how Coolidge, you know, when he gets the news and gets sworn in and so forth. Okay, Cam Ree in the chat box there has posted the YouTube of what I was talking about, of the Calvin Coolidge clip that's on YouTube. So don't go now. You got to stay here, but put that aside for future viewing. So anyway, it's a charming story of how Coolidge gets sworn in because he was, like, helping his dad at the barn or something. It's not like he was out at the casino. All right, so I'm calling him Cool Cal. Of course, there's a pun on Calvin Coolidge, but really his nickname was Silent Cal. I've got one quote here from him. I just went to Wikipedia, and this one came from the book. I have a few in the Depression book, in the sidebars, those politically incorrect guides like to keep things really flowing and keep your interest by having all kinds of neat stuff going on in the margins. So I got a bunch of cool quotes from him in there. I actually had to just scale them back. I mean, there were tons of Calvin Coolidge. We start reading histories of the guy, and it's amazing. And so here's one. One of the greatest favors that can be bestowed upon the American people is economy and government. He has lots of little nuggets of wisdom like that. But anyway, one of his nicknames was Silent Cal, because they said he was a man of few words. So it could be apocryphal, but the famous story about that is he's at some party, and I think it was when he was president at the time, and some socialite lady comes up to him and says, "My friend wagered with me that I couldn't get you to say more than two words to me," you know, presumably batting her eyes and stuff, and he just goes, "You lose," and walks away. So that's, I mean, do I need to tell you more about how cool this guy is? Okay, 1920s fiscal history. So, in case some of you are foreign and don't understand what this is just a joke, this particular. So this is the primal guy, Mark Sisson. So I'm saying, what I mean by here is that it's a lean, mean federal budget. This guy over here on the right is Andrew Mellon. All right, so that's the non-joke. So Andrew Mellon is the Treasury Secretary for first Harding and then Coolidge and then Herbert Hoover, at least in the beginning. And so Mellon is widely thought to be the one who is the, I don't want to say the brains behind it, but the architect of Calvin Coolidge's tax cuts. And we're going to see those in a minute. Or you say the Harding-Coolidge tax cuts. So anyway, we're going to see very soon here the tremendous discipline of the federal government in the 1920s under the Harding and Coolidge administrations. And also the thing with Mellon is he is the guy that, if you've heard of this, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get, we may, if we're going to be able to work this in, but let me just say it now in case we get too much stuff going on later. This is kind of a fun little tidbit. So Herbert Hoover, in his memoirs, famously said that, you know, after the stock market crashed, we're in office, oh, what do? I have my advisors, and Mellon is his Treasury Secretary at the time, and Hoover is telling the story in Hoover's own memoirs. And Hoover, of course, this is years after the Depression, and everyone blames Herbert Hoover for the Great Depression. So Hoover's trying to exonerate himself in his memoirs. He's trying to tell people, oh, don't look at me. It wasn't my fault. And he's blaming everything. He's blaming Europe. He's blaming this. He's blaming that. So here he's trying to paint Mellon to be a jerk. And he says that, you know, Mellon wanted to just let there be a great liquidation, you know, liquidate the stocks, liquidate the farmers, blah, 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 liquidate labor until we find a new equilibrium, and we'll just blow this thing out. And then we'll, you know, once we hit rock bottom, then we'll recover. And so then that has gotten perverted, where now modern writers, and I saw this most egregiously by Brad DeLong, where Brad DeLong was giving a speech one time contrasting the Austerians with the, you know, sensible Keynesians who want to spend money and raise aggregate demand during a depression. And DeLong was saying, I mean, Herbert Hoover clearly was an Austerian subscribing to the theories of the Austrian school, because let me quote from his Treasury Secretary. And then he read from Hoover's memoirs saying, let's liquidate stocks, liquidate labor, liquidate the farmers. And then DeLong didn't go on to say on the next page how Herbert Hoover said, I didn't listen to Mellon's advice. What I did instead was, right, so anyway, let's make sure you're aware of that, that people who want to paint Herbert Hoover as some right-wing nut job love to quote from Andrew Mellon, who was his Treasury Secretary, and where they get that quote from is from Hoover in his memoirs telling the reader, aren't you glad I didn't listen to my nut job Treasury Secretary when the stock market crashed? Right, so just make sure you're aware of that. If you get my book, you'll see the full quotations and all that stuff in the citations. Okay. But for our purposes now, so again, keep in mind, it's the same guy. And if you go and Google him, I mean, progressive leftists are very skeptical of Mellon. He was a very wealthy man, and so, how can I put it? if you're the sort of person who's afraid of rich people taking over the government and putting in policies that favor the upper elite and screw the country, it is a very compelling story to say, oh my gosh, you got this fat cat who's running things. He gives big tax cuts to the rich under Calvin Coolidge, well, Harding and Coolidge. That causes the stock market bubble and crash. And then he tells Hoover to liquidate labor, liquidate farmers, and just, you know, screw everybody because the rich already got all their money because he gave them tax cuts. And it causes the Great Depression. Right? So you can see how that's a, it looks like all the elements that a typical progressive would want are there embodied in the spirit of this guy, Andrew Mellon. So just be aware of that. All right, so let's just walk through some of the raw facts here so you have the context. All right, so this is, if you want to see more about what where this chart's coming from and see some of the history, this here's the URL for this. This is actually from a paper that I wrote, a study for the Pacific Research Institute on the economic rationale for a flat tax. So this was for the state of California. They have an extremely progressive income tax at the state level. And so I did a study for this free market think tank out in California saying, you know, it would make, given that you're going to tax people, it makes more sense to da 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 da. All right. So anyway, this was a chart that I was using to show, to buttress the point that you can lower, by lowering the tax code, making it flatter, instead of having, you know, the bottom bracket get taxed at one at a certain percent, people making more than that getting taxed at a higher percent, people making more than that getting higher, da, da, da. Like, instead of doing that, what if you just lowered rates to give more incentive on the margin for people to go earn more income, particularly the most productive people who have the highest income levels? By lowering the marginal rate, you unleash them, and they go and earn more income, right? So this is what you guys probably all know of as supply-side economics, or more colloquially as the Laffer curve. Let me just write that out for the benefit of foreign. After the name of, or sorry, after Arthur Laffer, who is a famous supply-side economist that was one of the intellectual architects of the Ronald Reagan tax cuts of the early 1980s in the United States. So what's interesting here, the reason I'm bringing all this up, is Andrew Mellon anticipated the Reagan Revolution, or the, you know, the Laffer curve. Okay, so and there's, I don't have them in my, I don't know if I have it in the Depression book. It's certainly in this flat tax, well, I'm pretty sure it's in this flat tax paper. But anyway, the point is Andrew Mellon, as Treasury Secretary, was astute in terms of marginal analysis and tax code analysis, and he was saying, look at, during World War I, the top, or the federal income tax, the rates got raised to ridiculous levels. So you can see it right here. Here at the top, so look at this. See how high that was. All right, so at one point, just to give you an idea, so in 1913 is when the modern federal income tax is introduced in the United States. Right, so there had been a national income tax, like under Lincoln during the Civil War, the so-called Civil War, war between the states, whatever you want to call it. The income tax had been ruled unconstitutional, a federal income tax. Right? The way the U.S. Constitution was originally written, you couldn't levy a tax at the federal level in that way that the Supreme Court had ruled. So it took a constitutional amendment. And they did that in 1913. So at the time, the top rate was 7%. All right, so in 1913, they bring in this new federal income tax. Of course, the politicians are like, don't worry, this is just a little pinprick from the crumbs falling from the tables of the super rich people. Don't worry, this income tax is never going to be a big deal. Because at the time, the U.S. government got most of its revenue from tariffs. So they were actually arguing that this is going to be promote efficiency and it's going to be much fairer. The federal government will take its revenue in from rich people who won't be bothered by this trifling little pinprick we're going to take from them, and then we can lower tariff rates so that the rank and file, you know, can have a tax cut. That was the way they sold this to the American public in 1913, right? So again, top income tax rate was 7% when this thing was brought in 1913. Just 5 years later, the top federal rate was 77%. And so the rate had gone up by a factor of 11. Not 11%, a factor of 11. It went from 7% to 77% in just 5 years. And of course, you say, what the heck was going on? Well, it was World War I. All right, so at the end of World War I, the point is income tax rates are extremely high, punitively high. And so a lot of government bonds were tax exempt. Back then they did the same thing that they do now. They want to encourage you to lend money to government at various levels, so they exempt them from the income tax. And also the same thing here. The federal government, in addition to taxing the heck out of people, was also going massively into debt during World War I. We're going to see that in a couple of slides. And so they wanted to bring in more lending to the government. And one way to do that, of course, one way to get people to want to buy bonds is to exempt them from taxation. Right? So in other words, you can earn income from other types of investments and it gets hit with a 77 or whatever the top rate percent tax is, or you can lend money to Uncle Sam and not have the interest on those bonds get taxed. So, duh, you're going to want to lend money to Uncle Sam. Okay, so what Mellon did, among other things, is he analyzed the situation when he came in and, you know, was telling Harding and then presumably Coolidge, you know, this is crazy. This is counterproductive. These tax rates are so high, we're not even bringing in a lot of revenue, let alone is it, you know, unfair in the grand scheme of things for us to be taxing so much. And he said, you don't want people to channel all of their savings into just buying government bonds. That's not productive. what you want, what we need to do is lower the marginal rates of taxation so that people start investing in other lines and that people have incentive to enlarge their taxable income, right? So they shift their investments, they shift their activities so that now more of them are exposed to the lower tax rate. Whereas when the tax rate is 70% plus, you're just playing defense. All you're doing is arranging your whole operations in view of, I need to minimize my tax liability because these rates are so outrageous. And he's pointing out, we don't want a nation of people with our most productive citizens thinking like that. We want them out there saying, how can I earn more income? How can I grow my business? All right, so that was the rationale behind it. Like, so like I say, he was pretty astute. You know, if you read his analysis, it was remarkably supply side, and it sounds just like somebody who was commenting on the Ronald Reagan's plan, even though he was writing it in like 1920. Okay, so anyway, that was the historical context, and so you can see they actually did do that. So you see how there were waves of tax rate reductions. So they didn't just do it all at once. They lowered them sharply up front. Then a few years in there, they lowered them some more, and so forth. So you can see over time how starting up here in the 70s percentages, eventually by 1925, it's in the mid-20s. Okay, so for a 4-year stretch to have the top marginal income tax rate go from being in the 70s plus range, dropping by about 50 points, 50 percentage points, right now in the United States, if it dropped that much, there would just be no taxes. Because they're not that high to begin with. You couldn't drop it that much because it'd be zero. Right, so that's pretty amazing. And now the other amazing thing is this solid line. You can look at the tax receipts, and you can see how you would think, and that's what a lot of critics said at the time, that this was reckless, because now how's the federal government going to get any revenue if you cut taxes so much? And that's the thing, you gotta be careful. And I, for you guys who don't know, I actually used to work for Arthur Laffer, so that's why this particular lesson has been drilled into my head. But he would be very clear, he never used the phrase tax cut, because that's ambiguous. If they say, oh yeah, the government should cut taxes, or you know, Ronald Reagan cut taxes, or here, oh yeah, Calvin Coolidge cut taxes, what do you mean by that? Because according to revenues, no, it looks like he raised taxes. See here, this huge growth in the dollar amount collected by the federal government. And so what Laffer would always do to be very precise would be talk about tax rate reductions or increases. Because it works the other way, too. If a politician comes into office and says, hey, we need to raise taxes because we got to pay for more spending, or because we got to stop running such big deficits, so let's raise taxes, and you hike the tax rate, depending on where you are on the so-called Laffer curve, it might actually be counterproductive. All right, so that's what happened here. You can see that even though the tax rate was cut sharply, tax receipts by the late 20s were much higher than the early one, early 20s. Now, having said all that, the typical supply side interpretation of this is to say, see, it's our theory at work. An Austrian economist might be a little bit more skeptical and say, wait a minute. There really wasn't a huge explosion until 27 and 28. And maybe that's because of the stock market bubble, right? So it's, you know, it's not necessarily because of the logic of supply side incentives and giving people the you know, the marginal analysis to an incentive to go produce more. It could be the stock bubble, to which, you know, the supply side was, yeah, exactly. Look at all this wealth that we generated by our tax rate reductions. And then the Austrians is, oh, but look at the Fed. Okay, so that's a fight we'll get into perhaps a little bit more next week as well. But I'm just explaining it, and that's one of the problems with evaluating the 1920s in general as an Austrian economist is, on the one hand, you want to say, let me do one more slide and then I'll tell you this is the problem. Okay, so here's a slide. I don't know if you can see this well with the broadcast. The charts are there. This PowerPoint you guys can get every week. It'll be made available to you, and so it's posted here in the chat box. If you haven't seen that, the link for you to be able to download this PowerPoint and have your stuff on your computer. So if you can't make out these axes, then you might want to do that. But what this is showing you is, so this data right here is 1915, and then here's 1929. So I gave you a little bit before the U.S. entry into World War I so you could see just how colossal the spending increase was because of World War I for the U.S. government and what happened with its deficit. Right, so on this chart, this line here is outlays, meaning expenditures by the U.S. federal government. This line here are receipts, and these are all in millions, by the way. And then the dotted line is the surplus or the deficit. So note that this is the zero line. So when this dotted line is below this, that means it's a deficit. And when it's above, it means it's a surplus. So you can see what happened. The federal government didn't spend very much. Then enters World War I, spending just goes to the roof, up to about $18 billion annually. Then it comes down sharply. In this, incidentally, this period here, this is what Tom Woods and I spent a lot of time talking about the 1920 and 21 Depression. All right, so for this course, we just don't have time to cover that too much. We might get into it a little bit later, just when we're looking at the monstrous and Keynesian explanations of the Great Depression. But the point is, you can see, put it this way, if you thought the reason the Great Depression were so bad, or that the reason we didn't have an adequate recovery from the Obama stimulus package and all that stuff, was that, oh, gee, the government didn't just spend enough. We had this premature austerity, the way Paul Krugman and guys like that say. It's pretty hard to explain why the 1920 and 21 Depression wasn't awful, because you can see this huge spending cut that happened there. And maybe we'll get into that a little bit more in the next few weeks. But for what we're talking about right now, I just want you to understand why I think Calvin Coolidge is so awesome. So look at what happened here. So you can see that so revenues did increase. This light blue line here, which, you know, isn't that shocking that they raised tax rates pretty substantially. And also, there was a lot of wartime inflation. And so these are nominal revenues. So, you know, the price level's going way up. It's not surprising that the number of dollars collected by the federal government in taxes is also rising sharply during the war years. So then 1920 and 21, things come back down, and you can see this huge cut. And so then look at this. For every single year in the decade of the 1920s, the federal government ran a budget surplus. And you can also see that outlays were fairly constant over the entire stretch stretch starting from 22, and if you started it in 1920, outlays were lower in 1929 than they were in 1920. Right. So what I'm getting at here is Calvin Coolidge was in office during what was called the Roaring Twenties. I mean, this was one of the biggest boom periods in U.S. history, perhaps the biggest. And so, I mean, can you imagine if under the George Bush administration, federal spending, not as a share of GDP, just total number of dollars that the U.S. federal government spent, can you imagine it basically stayed the same over 8 years as the economy's booming and everyone's getting fantastically rich, at least on paper? I mean, that is the financial discipline of the Coolidge administration. All right, so, and of course, Andrew Mellon had a lot to do with that. So this, now part of why they did that was that the federal government had run up this monstrous debt, right? So this is showing the deficit, but obviously, you know, the area under the curve would be the accumulation of the total federal debt during the war. Right? So that, in terms of what the federal government had been used to in the history, to have that much debt was just inconceivable. Not inconceivable, it was unprecedented for sure. So what I'm getting at is that the people back then, remember, we're still on the classical gold standard, at least in the United States. And I think there was this mentality, because this is before the Keynesian Revolution, this idea that, well, yeah, during an emergency like a world war, where you think the fate of Western Europe, you know, freedom in Europe and the rule of law, and so if you think that's under siege, sure, you borrow a bunch of money because there's an emergency, but then what do? Once you get through that, and especially when times are good, you pay down the debt. That's the responsible thing to do. So yeah, you can run up debt during an emergency, but just like a household or a corporation, then when you get through the emergency, you don't just let the debt sit there. You certainly don't add to it. You pay it off. And so that's what Coolidge did. Now he didn't retire the debt, but he consistently chipped away at it, is what I'm getting at here. And again, I mean, what's particularly amazing about that is that he did it even during this boom period. He held spending in check. Now, one thing I want to mention, some of you might be confused here before we move on, is the receipts it looks like they don't go up all that much during the 20s. And you say, wait a minute, what the heck? Didn't you just show us in the previous slide the tax receipts went way up in 1927 and 1928. So how come we're not seeing that in the next chart? And I believe, I should go double check this before I bet my life on it, but I think both charts are correct. I think that what's going on is here, this is income tax receipts, whereas this chart is total receipts at the federal level. So what I'm saying is there's no necessary contradiction between those two charts. They might both be correct. This data, I generated this chart today, and I got that from the White House's historical tables, and then that other chart that I showed you, I mean, that came from, like, it came from some non-job source. So presumably that information was correct also. All right, so that's one thing, and I would need to go do more investigation to figure out if that is the case, why was it like that? Because you would think if the economy is booming in 27 and 28, wouldn't tariff revenues and any other kind of internal duties that they levied, wouldn't that stuff all be overflowing too? So if income tax receipts are going through the roof, why wouldn't total federal receipts be going up like that too? And you can see, I mean, they do go up a little bit. Even on this chart from 26 to 27, but it certainly isn't like a thing jumping out of yet. So I'm not sure if the Coolidge administration, it's possible that the Coolidge administration intentionally didn't want to be taking in a lot of extra revenue, so that when income tax revenues went up, they might have intentionally cut rates on other things drastically so that you fell below that point in the Laffer curve and were taking in less total money from those other sources. I'm not sure off the top of my head. Okay. Somebody's asking me the source of that slide. There was this slide right here. This is it comes from the White House historical tables. It was I just Googled it this morning. So if you just go Google U.S. budget deficit 1920s, or there's like U.S. budget history, surplus deficit, something like that, it should be one of the top hits. And you can get like a nice Excel file that starts in like 1919 or so. No, even earlier, like 1901 is when it started. classical gold standard. So here, let me spend, in case you guys were wondering, this opening lecture, we're not really getting into the Great Depression per se, but it's because I want to give you, we'll get to it at the tail end of it, but I want to set up the framework because there's a lot of arguments about the Great Depression and its causes, and you need to know the historical context and how these other institutions and how they worked before you're able to really evaluate these people who say, oh, look at what happened in such and such. So, for example, why did I go over that stuff with Coolidge? Is, you know, if you're going to blame the Great Depression on Herbert Hoover's austerity, the fact that he wasn't willing to run big enough budget deficits, that's kind of weird since you saw what happened when Calvin Coolidge consistently ran surpluses and cut tax rate and held spending in check. And even though they had the 1920-21 depression. Right, so it's almost a mirror image. And you get more of that if you get my book to show that under the Coolidge administration, the 1920s were a fantastic boom period, and some of it obviously was artificial by the Fed, but I think a lot of it was genuine, where people, the transformation of the 20s is pretty amazing. There's lots of people getting cars for the first time. They're getting electricity. People start going to movie theaters, getting radio. I mean, so it's not just like, oh, their standard of living went up by 1 percentage point every year or something like that. I mean, their lives were transformed during the 1920s, and this happened amidst policies that would typically be derided as right-wing or laissez-faire or, you know, conservative or libertarian, whatever you want to call it. And then during the 30s, clearly, governments around the world, but also the United States, came the closest to central planning that has ever happened. And so I really love to just contrast the 20s and the 30s and show, what a coincidence. Imagine that, when they cut tax rates, hold spending in check, run consistent budget surpluses, we have one of the most prosperous decades in U.S. history. When they do the opposite of all those things, jack up tax rates, massively increase spending, run huge deficits, implement all sorts of controls over business, we have the worst decade in U.S. history. And so we conclude from that we need bigger government. I mean, that's what the Keynesians and the monetarists do. With the monetarists, by bigger government, meaning more intervention in money and banking. Right, so that's partly why I love to stress the facts of the 20s so much, just so you can see the contrast. Okay, the classical gold standard, let's talk a little bit about this, because here too, there's all sorts of myths behind this, and if you don't understand how it worked, then it's hard for you to evaluate when someone comes along and says, oh my gosh, look, at in 1933 FDR took the dollar off gold, and look at the sharp increase in the stock market. So clearly that was a good thing. I mean, if you don't know the historical context, it's kind of hard to even evaluate that claim. Let me say one thing very quickly about this. Before I move on, I want to make sure I don't miss this sort of big picture argument. People will often say, oh yeah, the gold standard caused the depression. And in a little while, we'll see a more nuanced, sophisticated argument along these lines. But you will get people just out of the chute saying, hey, gold standard causes the depression. That's why we went off gold, causes the depression. Ooh, you crazy, Ron Paul wants to put us back on gold. Don't you know that caused the depression? Right. That's an absurd claim. Depending on how you start and stop the timing of it, various governments were on the classical gold standard for decades. You know, in the case, in some cases, again, depending on what you consider to be being on gold, and if you broaden it and say being on silver, or being tied, having your money tied to a hard commodity money for centuries. And so to say the gold standard caused the depression doesn't make any sense. That would be like saying, the analogy I use in these sort of situations, it's like there's an awful plane, you know, a jet crashes. 200 people are flying from London to New York. And this big, huge jumbo jet goes down. 250 people die. And the investigators come and they look at it. And the reporters are asking them, what was the cause of the crash? And then they come back and they say, the cause of the crash was gravity. And that's stupid, right? I mean, yeah, you can argue that gravity was certainly involved with that, but clearly it makes no sense to say the reason that plane crashed is gravity, because there's plenty of planes that take off and land without crashing. All right, and so the same thing here. Why did the Great Depression occur when it did? If the gold standard had been in effect for so long before that, see what I'm saying? And it's the same thing too with you know, people saying the Federal Reserve didn't inflate enough. Well, how come we didn't have the Great Depression then before the Fed was even founded? I mean, the Fed really didn't inflate much before it existed. So how come we didn't have the Great Depression in 1912? You see what I'm saying? So it's that kind of thing where just on the face of it, a lot of these quick shooting from the hip explanations of the Great Depression, they just don't even make any sense. Because the cause that they put their finger on had been in operation for at least decades, and in some cases, you know, arguably more than a century. And then, yet they're saying, and that's why in 1929, the gold standard finally was our undoing. It doesn't make any sense. Okay. So let me walk you through this. I'm just making sure I don't get mixed up on time here. So I'm going to go for an hour and 15 minutes. It's screwy because we started at the half hour, right? So I'm going to go to 6:45 Eastern and then turn over to Q&A. Let me set my things so I don't get that. I'm sorry, I'll remember. Okay. By the way, if in the notes here, if I'm going over time, you guys remind me. It's hard for me to think in terms of the half hour. Okay. So let's walk through this. And again, the point is I want to make sure you guys understand how the classical gold standard worked. And the reason I'm working through this numerical example is it didn't really click with me until I wrote this thing out and just and walked myself through it to make sure I understood the logic of it. So if you already know this, I apologize for the redundancy, but I'm imagining a lot of you have never actually seen someone walk it through a specific numerical example. Okay, so historically, and I'm not the expert here, Joe Salerno knows way more about this stuff than I do, but remember, historically, money emerged from the market as an actual commodity money. And I'm sure a lot of you know the theory that Karl Menger came up with, the most coherent, satisfactory explanation for how that could have been. At some point, there must not have been money, right? Because money is not a natural thing the way apples are. So at some point, money didn't exist. And at some point in human history, people are using money. So clearly, there was a point at which it came into existence. But how did that happen? And a lot of people thought, oh, well, it must have been a wise king or some elders of some tribe or something just ordered it. And that doesn't really make much sense. So there's various objections to that. Chief among which is if you've never actually seen money in operation, it's kind of a crazy idea. Right? If you picture a bunch of people in barter, where they make voluntary trades because, hey, you have something I want, and I have something you want. We're both better off if we make this trade. Why don't we do that? Well, that makes sense. And then someone comes along and says, how about we grab these shells? And now if you want to give up your horse for something else, trade your horse for a bunch of these shells that are intrinsically useless to you. But don't worry, because you can get somebody else to take those shells and get the thing you want. I mean, if somebody started saying that, he'd probably get punched in the face. It sounds stupid. It's only because we know the benefits of monetary exchange now, in hindsight, we can see why society does benefit from having everything trade against one one commodity. All right. So Menger came up with a good explanation for how historically that could have happened, just what we would now call spontaneously. That people realize certain goods are more marketable than others. So this is before money exists. You've got pigs that you're trying to unload, and you want eggs, but all the guys who have eggs don't want pigs for some reason that day. But somebody else is willing to give you bread for your pigs. And you know that a lot of people like bread. So you trade your pigs for the bread, even though you don't want bread. So then you trade the bread for the eggs. All right. So now in that example, the bread was a medium of exchange. It's not yet money. It was a medium of exchange, though. So that process snowballs, where certain commodities, because they're more marketable, because more people are willing to trade for them, just because of the preferences initially, more people like the thing, it starts being accepted by other people who don't want it for direct use. And then that thing's a medium of exchange, and then it snowballs. So through that process, certain items such as gold and silver prove to be extraordinarily good media of exchange for various reasons. Obviously, bread's not a good medium of exchange because it goes bad on you. It can, you know, go stale or gets moldy, after which nobody would want it. Whereas gold and silver are quite durable. They can even, you can have gold coins in a pirate ship that sinks at the bottom of the ocean for 100 years, and divers go find it, and it's still good. Whereas a loaf of bread's not going to last going down the ship. All right. They're also easily divisible. Right, so a diamond, even though in many respects diamonds you might think are just as good at being media of exchange as gold and silver, they're actually not, because you can't take a 1-pound diamond and cut it in half and then have, you know, oh, now I've got just a half a pound of diamond and a half a pound of that, you know, part of what the appeal of a diamond is its shape and the, you know, the angles and so forth, and it has to be cut very precisely, whereas gold, you can cut it in half and that's fine, you can just melt it and put it back together again if you want to, whereas you can't really do that with the diamond. Okay, so for those various reasons, and then also they're historically, their market exchange value, you know, the sorts of things you could buy with them per unit of weight of the metal was convenient. The gold was more valuable per unit weight of gold, so it would be used for bigger purchases, whereas silver was less valuable, but it was convenient to make coins of silver for either change or for small purchases. Whereas, like, platinum, you might think, oh, how come platinum wasn't used by everybody around the world as money? Well, because it was too scarce. Okay, and there's probably other metals also that, or, you know, copper maybe was not scarce enough, or aluminum, or something like that. Okay, so you see the way that works. Okay. So for those various reasons, that's why gold and silver historically were the market's choice of money. So then governments wanting to get in on the act, and there were also, let me back up, banking was also a market phenomenon at first. That for various reasons, it's inconvenient to be lugging around a bunch of metal, and so you would deposit it with a person who would then give you paper claims, tickets, redemption claims, or give you a book on which you could write claims and give them to people, and they would go to the person that you had deposited this physical metal with, and they would get reimbursed for it. Right? So that was banking, checkbook deposits, and so forth. So then governments, of course, muscled in into that those arenas. So you had this situation where you had national monetary currency, let's call it, but they were tied to the precious metals. And the thing here is, it's not so much, it's not really pegged but more defined as okay. So now here, I'm not getting into the weeds of the details of this, because technically, if you talk to a purist, he's going to say the dollar was defined as such and such of silver. like going back historically, and then it was only with further legislation that now the dollar is viewed in terms of gold. Right, so like I say, that it's fascinating stuff. I don't want to get it. We don't need to know that for the limited purposes of this course. But what I'm trying to get at here is, because all of us have grown up in an age of fiat money, where the money is not linked to anything, I think even when we think back historically of this period, we're imagining it as back then the people thought the dollar was fiat also, but oh, for right now, the government promises to redeem these paper things for a certain weight of gold, you know, the same way that if the government tomorrow were to say we're going to start redeeming the dollar in gold at such and such an exchange rate or a peg, you know, we would think of it that way. But I think it was more than that. Metaphysically, back then, I mean, if you, I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but I really want to make sure you get what I'm saying. If you read Mises in the Theory of Money and Credit, to see him talking about the theoretical possibility of fiat money, it's really fascinating. So on the one hand, so what I'm getting at is Mises in the Theory of Money and Credit in the first edition, what was that, 1912? He's laying out the various categories, you know, so there's commodity money, there's credit money, and then there's fiat money. And he's saying, yeah, this is theoretically possible. You know, but he's kind of like, come on. You know, so it's amazing. So first of all, he's a good economist, that he understood, you know, he imagined something that he, in his mind hadn't ever existed. But my point is, back then, I mean, the notion of fiat money, the idea that the government could just print up pieces of paper and that's where our money would be, I mean, that would shock people. I mean, somebody, I forget who it was, when the British government went off gold in the 30s, some finance minister or somebody said, like, this is the end of Western civilization. Like, and he wasn't making a joke. Like, he really thought, how can it be that the Great Britain, of all places, you know, the financial center of the universe, now the pound isn't going to be backed up by gold? Are you kidding me? Like, he just thought that was it. And which way, nowadays a lot of Keynesians make fun of that guy. Like, I've seen Brad DeLong quote that and stuff. And said, well, they did have World War II, you know, the Holocaust and all this other stuff, right, you know, soon following that. So in terms of being the end of Western civilization, he arguably was correct. You know, in other words, the modern Keynesians are like, you think civilization broke down, and what would it look like if civilization did break down? Wouldn't it look like millions of people getting killed? So, anyway, back to the boring calculations here. So under the classical gold standard, look, it would have existed on the eve of World War One. This is what happened. So you had the U.S. government was announcing to anybody, so it could be just Joe Blow off the street, says, hey, if you turn in $20.67 of U.S. currency, then we will give you 1 troy ounce of gold. Or vice versa, you know, if you give us 1 troy ounce of gold, 31.1 grams, we will give you, we stand prepared to give you $20.67 in U.S. currency. And the British, the Bank of England, had a similar pledge with the pound, saying 4.25 British pounds entitles you to 1 troy ounce of gold. Okay, so the time period, someone's asking about the time period. I'm not sure when this would have started, but this is, let's say, as of 1913. So I'm saying before World War One, when the period of the classical gold standard was in operation. It was in effect for long before then too, but I don't want to give you a start date, because like I said, then you get these issues of, well, a dollar used to be tied to silver, and then there was a bimetallism period and all that stuff. Alright. So this is why, if you read historical accounts from like the 20s or the 30s, you might see people referring to the fact of the pound being worth $4.86. Sometimes I've seen people round a cent or two, the loan, you know, like they might say 487 or 485, but most people say 486, and if you do the math, it rounds to 486. All right, so you guys get how that works, right? It's just $20.67 is an ounce of gold, and an ounce of gold is 4.25 pounds, then you just divide through, so 1 pound is $4.86 in U.S. dollars. That's pretty obvious. Okay, now, the thing, though, is there were foreign currency markets, foreign exchange markets. Right, so there weren't price controls in effect. And that's the thing, too. A lot of times people who are modern critics of the gold standard will say of Ron Paul, oh my gosh, he wants to put a price control on gold. What an idiot. You know, in other words, saying you Austrians, or like at this period here, the U.S. government had a price control in effect on gold, saying gold had to be $20.67. and calling an appointment. No, it's not. It's not a price control. Okay, and this too. To say the pound would trade for $4.86, nobody was backing that up with guns. It's not that if somebody in the foreign exchange market wanted to trade a pound for $5, he was going to go to jail or get fined. In fact, the foreign exchange rate did fluctuate, and so in a minute I'm going to show you why they were brought back. The point is, the government stood prepared to redeem their currencies for gold and vice versa at those official rates. So it would be stupid for you to sell an ounce of gold for less than $20.67. Like, no one would stop you. If you wanted to sell an ounce of gold for $18, you could. But why would you do that? You could sell it to Uncle Sam for $20.67. And then on the other hand, if you wanted to buy gold, if you wanted to buy it for $25 an ounce, you could. But why would you do that? That would be stupid. You could just go down to the government and get it for $20.67. Okay, so that's the sense in which the dollar was fixed to gold. And the dollar price of an ounce of gold was locked in, but it wasn't a price control the way rent control is a price control on apartment buildings. Okay, so make sure you understand that nobody's enforcing this at gunpoint. This was the government tying its own hands. The government making a promise to the rest of the world saying, we're printing up these things with pictures of U.S. presidents on them, and we have a bunch of gold in our vault, and we promise if you turn in $20.67, we'll give you an ounce of gold. Or if you give us an ounce of gold, we'll happily give you $20.67 in currency. All right, so that's not a control. That's not interfering with the market. That's interfering with the government. That's imposing a constraint on the government. One last little tidbit for the purists out there. There was what we would call it a bid-ask spread. All right, so there were transaction costs or seniorage fees, if you will. So it wasn't literally that. 2067, whether you're buying or selling gold to the government, there's a little bit of a shaving one way or the other. But these were the, it was like for handling costs. Okay, so given that those are the exchange rates, how does that constrain governments and and what do I mean when I'm saying that this exchange rate is, this is like an anchor. Okay, so again, in practice, if you were a foreign currency trader and you looked in the Wall Street Journal on a Tuesday in 1913 at what the pound dollar exchange rate was that afternoon, it might not be $4.86. It might be something else. But the point is, there would be forces set in motion that would push it back toward that 486. So it might be a little higher, it might be a little lower, but if it strayed too much, it would set up an arbitrage opportunity that would quickly push it back. And then speculators, knowing that, might even not let it diverge that much in the first place, if you understand what I'm saying. So in other words, I'm going to talk to you in the next slide about the ultimate backstop, the thing that would ultimately prevent the pound dollar exchange rate from straying too far from 486. But even before that barrier were breached, speculators would probably attack it soon.